It's moving, he says almost inaudibly. Now you're walking up to the door, Eric says. The night air is mild. There's nothing unpleasant. Björn starts as some jackdaws fly up from a tree. They're visible against the sky, their shadows move across the grass, and then they're gone. You're perfectly safe, Eric says, as he sees Björn's hand move anxiously over the seat of the sofa. Chapter 15. Deep in his trance, Björn slowly approaches the door. He keeps to the stone path, but something about the black shimmer of the window catches his attention. You've reached the door. You take your key out and put it in the lock, Eric says. Björn carefully pushes the handle, but the door is stuck. He tries harder, and there's a sticky sound when it eventually opens. Eric sees that Björn's brow is sweating and repeats in a soothing voice that there's nothing to be scared of. Björn tries to open his eyes and whisper something. Eric leans forward and feels his breath against his ear. The doorstep. Something odd about it. Yes, this doorstep has always been odd, Eric replies calmly. But once you've crossed it, everything will be just as it was on Friday. Eric notes that the whole of Björn's face is covered with a sheen of sweat as his chin begins to tremble. No, no, he whispers, shaking his head. Eric realizes that he needs to put him in deeper hypnosis if he is to be able to enter the house. All you have to do now is listen to my voice, Eric says, because soon you'll be in an even more relaxed state, and there's nothing to be worried about there. You're sinking deeper as I count. Four, you're sinking. Three, getting calmer. Two, one, and now you're completely relaxed and can see that the doorstep isn't any sort of barrier. Björn's face is slack. His mouth is hanging open, one corner wet with saliva. He's in a deeper state of hypnosis than Eric had intended. If you feel ready, you can cross the threshold now. Björn doesn't want to. He's thinking that he doesn't want to, but he still takes a step into the hall. He looks along the corridor towards the kitchen. Everything is the same as usual. There's an advertisement from Bauhaus on the doormat. Too many shoes piled up on the shoe rack. The umbrella that always falls over does so again, and his keys jangle as he puts them on the chest of drawers. Everything is the same as usual, he whispers. The same as... He falls silent when he notices a strange rolling movement from the corner of his eye. He daren't turn to look in that direction and stares straight ahead while something moves at the edge of his field of vision. There's something strange off to the side. What did you say? Eric asks. It's moving. Off to the side. Okay, just let it go, Eric replies. Look straight ahead and keep going. Björn walks through the hall, but his eyes keep getting drawn to the side, towards the clothes hanging in the porch. They're moving slowly in the gloom, as if a wind were blowing through the house. The sleeves of Susanna's trench coat lift in a gust, then fall back. Look ahead of you, Eric says. Someone suffering mental trauma experiences a chaotic jumble of memories that press in on them from all sides. They lose all coherence, fade away, and lurch into view, all mixed up. All Eric can do is try to lead Björn through the rooms towards the fundamental insight that he couldn't have prevented his wife's death. "I'm in the kitchen now," he whispers. "Keep going," Eric says. There's a bag of newspapers for recycling in the passageway leading to the door of the cellar. Björn takes a cautious step forward, looking straight ahead, but he still sees a kitchen drawer slide open, and it rattles when it comes to a halt.
"One drawer is open," he mutters.
"Which one?" Björn knows it's the drawer containing the knives, and he knows that he's the one opening it, seeing as he washed a large knife several hours earlier.
"Oh, God, I can't, I..."
"There's nothing to be afraid of. You're safe, and I'll be with you as you go further in."
"I'm walking past the door to the cellar, towards the living room. Susanna must have gone to bed already."
It's quiet. The television is switched off, but something's different. The furniture seems to be in the wrong places, as if a giant had picked the house up and given it a gentle shake.
"Sanna?"
Björn whispers. He reaches out his hand towards the light switch. The room doesn't light up, but the glow fills the windows that look out onto the garden. He can't help thinking he's being watched, and feels an urge to close the curtains.
"God, oh God, oh God,"
he suddenly whimpers, his face trembling. Eric realizes that Björn is there now, in the midst of his memory of the traumatic event. But he's barely describing anything. He's keeping it to himself. Björn is getting closer, sees himself in the black window, sees the bushes outside move in the wind, far beyond the reflections. He's gasping, even though he's under deep hypnosis. His body tenses and his back arches. "What's happening?" Eric asks. Björn stops when he sees someone with a dark grey face looking back at him in the window, right next to the glass. He takes a step back and feels his heart pounding hard in his chest. A branch of the rosebush sways and scrapes the window ledge. He realizes that the grey face isn't outside. There's someone sitting on the floor in front of the window. He can see their reflection. A calm voice repeats that there's nothing to be scared of. He moves to the side and realizes that it's Susanna. She's sitting on the floor in front of the window.
"Sanna,"
he says quietly, so as not to startle her. He can see her shoulder, some of her hair. She's leaning back against an armchair, looking out. He approaches cautiously and feels that the floor is wet beneath his feet.
"She's sitting down," he mutters.
"She's sitting?" Björn goes closer to the armchair by the window, and then the light in the ceiling comes on, and the room is bathed in light. He knows he's switched it on, but is still frightened when the bright light fills the room. There's blood everywhere. He's trodden in blood. It's splashed across the television and sofa, and up the walls there are smears of blood on the floor, trickling into the gaps between the wood. She's sitting on the floor in a dark red pool. A dead woman wearing Sanna's kimono. Dust has settled on the pool of blood around her. Eric sees Björn's face tense, and his lips and the tip of his nose turn white. As soon as Björn has realized that the dead woman is his wife, Eric is planning to bring him out of the hypnosis. "Who can you see?" he asks.
"No. No,"
he whispers. "You know who it is," Eric says.
"Susanna,"
he says slowly and opens his eyes. "You can move back now," Eric says. "I'm going to wake you up in a moment, and
there's so much blood. God, I don't want to. Her face, it's been destroyed, and she's sitting perfectly still with
Björn. Listen to my voice. I'm going to count from..."
"She's sitting with her hand over her ear, and there's blood dripping from her elbow, he says, panting for breath. Eric feels an icy chill as adrenaline fills his veins for a few seconds. The hairs on his arms and the back of his neck stand up. With his heart pounding, he glances towards the closed door of the treatment room and hears a trolley rattle as it moves away. Look at your own hands, he says, trying to keep his voice steady. You're looking at your own hands and you're breathing slowly. With each breath, you're feeling calmer.
I don't want to, Björn whispers.
Eric can feel that he's forcing him, but he has to know the position Björn's wife was sitting in when he found her. Before I wake you up, we need to go deeper, he says, swallowing hard. Beneath the house that you're in is another house, identical to the other one. But down there is the only place you can see Susanna clearly. 3, 2, 1. And now you're there. She's sitting on the floor in the pool of blood, and you can look at her without feeling frightened.
Her face is almost gone. It's just blood,
Björn says sluggishly.
And her hand is stuck to her ear.
Keep going, Eric says, glancing at the door again.
Her hand is tangled up in the cord of her kimono.
Björn, I'm going to bring you up now to the house above, and the only thing you know there is that Susanna is dead, and that there was nothing you could have done to save her. That's the only thing you're going to take with you when I wake you up. You're going to leave everything else behind. Chapter 16. Eric closes his office door and goes over to his desk. He feels that his back is wet with sweat when he sits down.
It's nothing, he whispers anxiously to himself.
He moves the mouse to wake his computer up, then logs in. With his hand trembling, he pulls open the top drawer, presses a Mogadon out of a blister pack, and swallows it without water. He quickly signs into the database of patients and notices how cold his fingers are as he waits to be able to perform a search. He jumps when Superintendent Margot Silverman opens the door without knocking. She walks in and stops in front of him with her hands clasped round her stomach.
Björn Kern says he can't remember what you talked about.
That's natural, Eric replies, minimizing the document.
How did you get on with the hypnosis then?
She asks, running her hand over the wooden elephant from Malaysia.
He was definitely receptive.
So you were able to hypnotize him? She smiles. I'm afraid I forgot to start the camera. Eric lies. Otherwise, I could have shown you. He went into a trance almost instantly.
You forgot to start the camera?
You know that this wasn't an official interview, he says, a touch impatiently. This was a first step towards what we call effective stabilization, so that
I don't give a damn about that,
she cuts him off. So that you can have a functional witness later on, he concludes.
How much later? Will he be able to say anything later today?
I think he's going to realize what happened fairly quickly, but talking about it is another matter.
So what happened? What did he say? He must have said something, surely.
Yes, but
no fucking oath of confidentiality bollocks now. She interrupts. I have to know, otherwise people will die.
Eric goes over to the window and leans on the sill. Far below, a patient is standing smoking, thin and bent-backed in his hospital gown. I took him back, Eric says slowly, into the house. It was rather complicated,
because it was very recent, and full of fragments of terrible memories.
But he saw everything? Could he see everything?
It was only to make him understand that he couldn't have saved her.
But he saw the murder scene, and his wife, did he?
Yes, he did, Eric replies.
So, what did he say?
Not much. He talked about blood and the wounds to her face.
Was she in a particular position, a posture with sexual implications?
He didn't say.
Was she sitting up or lying down? How did her mouth look? Where were her hands? Was she naked, violated?
He said very little, Eric replies. It can take a long time to reach details of that sort.
I swear if he doesn't start talking, I'll take him into custody, she says in a loud voice. I'll drag him off to headquarters and watch him like a hawk until...
Margot, Eric interrupts in a friendly voice. She looks at him with a subdued expression, nods and breathes through her mouth, then pulls out a business card and puts it down on his desk.
We don't know who his next victim's going to be. It could be your wife. Think about that, she says, and leaves the room.
Eric feels his face relax. He walks slowly back to his desk. The floor is starting to feel soft beneath his feet. As he sits down in front of his computer, there's a knock on the door.
Yes?
That charming superintendent has left the building, Nelly says, peering round the door. She's only trying to do her job.
I know. She doesn't really seem too bad.
Stop it, he says, but can't help smiling.
No, but she was pretty funny,
Nelly says, and laughs. Eric rests his head on his hand, and she turns serious and walks in, closes the door behind her, and looks at him.
What is it?
She asks.
What's happened?
Nothing, he replies.
Tell me,
she insists, sitting down on the corner of his desk. Her red woolen dress crackles with static electricity against her nylon tights as she crosses her legs.
I don't know, Eric sighs. What's up with you?
She laughs. Eric stands up, takes a deep breath, and looks at her.
Nelly, he says, and she can hear how empty his voice sounds.
I need to ask you about a patient. Before you started working here, Nina Bloom put together a team for a complicated research project.
Go on,
she says, looking at him with obvious curiosity. I know I outlined my cases to you, but this may not have been included.
I mean, what's the patient's name? She asks calmly. Rocky Schirklund. Do you remember him?
Yes. Hang on, she says tentatively. He was a priest.
Exactly. I remember. You talked about him quite a lot, she says as she thinks. You had a file of pictures from the crime scene, and
you don't remember where he ended up? He interrupts.
That was years ago, she replies.
He's still inside, though, isn't he?
We'd better hope so, she replied. He'd killed people, after all, hadn't he?
A woman. Eric nods.
That's right. Now I remember. Her whole face was destroyed.
Chapter 17. Nelly stands behind Eric as he makes his way through the patient database on his computer. He types Rocky Schirklund's name, searches, and discovers that he was sent to Karsuden District Hospital.
Karsuden, he says quietly.
She brushes a strand of blonde hair from her cheek and looks at him, her eyes narrowing.
Do you want to tell me why we are talking about this patient?
Rocky Schirklund's victim had been posed. You won't remember, but she was lying on the floor with her face horribly disfigured, and her hand round her neck. I've just hypnotized Bjorn Kern, and he described details that were very reminiscent of the old murder.
The one committed by the priest?
I don't know, but Björn Kern said his wife's face had been completely destroyed, and that she was sitting with her hand over her ear.
What do the police say?
I don't know, Eric mutters. I mean, you did tell that lovely pregnant lady.
I didn't tell her anything, Eric says.
You didn't? She asks, a skeptical smile playing at the corners of her mouth. Because it emerged while he was under hypnosis, but he wanted to talk, didn't he?
I might have misheard, Eric says.
Misheard? She laughs. It's just so sick. I can't think clearly anymore.
Eric, it probably isn't important, but you have to tell the police. That's why they're here, Nelly says gently.
He walks over to the window. The area where the patients stand and smoke is empty now, but he can still see the cigarette butts and sweet wrappers that have been tossed on the ground, and a blue shoe cover that's been pushed into the ashtray. It's a long time ago, but to me, do you know what those weeks were like? I didn't want Rocky to be released, Eric says slowly. It was everything. The brutality, the eyes, the hands.
I know. I read all about it, Nelly says. I don't remember the details of your recommendation, but I know you said he was seriously bloody dangerous and that there was a severe risk of a relapse.
What if he's out? I've got to call Karsuden, Eric says, then picks up his phone, checks his computer, and dials the number for Simon Casillas, the senior consultant in charge. Nelly sits down on Eric's sofa while he talks to the doctor and smiles at him when he looks at her as he exchanges the usual pleasantries, and when he ends the conversation by repeating that the consultant's article in Swedish Psychiatry really was excellent. The sun passes behind a cloud and darkness falls across the room as if a huge figure were standing in front of the building. Rocky is still in Ward D4, Eric says, and he's never been let out on parole.
Does that feel better?
No,
he whispers.
Are you losing your grip? She asks, so seriously that he can't help smiling. He sighs and puts his hands to his face, then slowly lowers them, feeling his fingertips press gently against his eyelids and down his cheeks, before he looks at Nelly again. Her back is straight as she looks at him carefully. A tiny, sharp little wrinkle has appeared between her thin eyebrows.
Okay, listen, Eric says. I know this is completely wrong, but in one of the last conversations I had with Rocky, he claimed he had an alibi for the night of the murder, but I didn't want him to be released simply because he'd bought himself a witness.
What are you trying to say?
She asks quietly. I never passed that information on.
No way, she says.
He could have been released. Bloody hell! You can't do that, she interrupts. I know, but he was guilty, and he would have killed again.
That's not our business. We're psychologists, we're not detectives, and we aren't judges.
She takes a few agitated steps, then stops and shakes her head.
Fucking hell, she gasps. You're mad. You're completely...
I can understand you being angry.
Yes, I am angry. I mean, you know, if this gets out, you'd lose your job.
I know what I did was wrong. It's tormented me ever since. But I've always been utterly convinced that I stopped a murderer.
Shit, she mutters.
He picks up the business card from his desk and begins to dial the superintendent's number.
What are you doing? She asks.
I need to tell her about Rocky's alibi and the whole business about the hand and the ear and...
Go ahead, she interrupts.
But what if you were right? What if his alibi wasn't real? Then any similarities are just coincidence.
I don't care. Then ask yourself... what you're going to do with the rest of your life, she says. You'll have to give up being a doctor. You'll lose your income. You might even face charges. All the scandal and gossip in the papers. It's my own fault.
Find out if the alibi checks out first. If it does, then I'll report you myself.
Thanks, he laughs.
I'm being serious, she says.
Chapter 18. Eric leaves the car in front of the garage, hurries up the path to his dark house, unlocks the door, and goes inside. He turns the light on in the hall, but doesn't take his outdoor clothes off, just carries on down the steep staircase to the cellar that contains his extensive archive. In the locked steel cabinets, he keeps all the documents from his years in Uganda, from the major research project at the Karolinska Institute, and about his patients at the psychology clinic. All the written material is collected in the form of logbooks, personal journals, and extensive notes. The recordings of his sessions have been saved on 8 external hard drives. Eric's heart is thumping as he unlocks one of the cabinets and searches back in time to the year when his life crossed paths with that of Rocky Kirklund. He pulls the file out of a black box and hurries upstairs to his study. He switches the lamp on, glances at the black window, removes the elastic band round the file, and opens it on the desk in front of him. It was 9 years ago, and life was very different. Benjamin was still in primary school. Simone was writing her dissertation in art history, and he himself had just started working at the Crisis and Trauma Center with Professor Sten W. Jakobson. He no longer remembers the exact details of how he was contacted and invited to join a team for a forensic psychology project. He had actually decided not to take part in anything like that again, but given the particular circumstances, changed his mind when his colleague Nina Bloom asked for his help. Eric remembers spending the evening in his new office, reading the material the prosecutor had sent over. The man who was going to be evaluated was Rocky Kirklund, and he was vicar of the parish of Salem. He was being held in custody on suspicion of having murdered Rebecca Hanson, a 43-year-old woman who had attended Mass and then stayed behind to speak to him in private on the Sunday before she was murdered. The murder had been extremely aggressive, fueled by hatred. The victim's face and arms had been destroyed. She was found lying on the linoleum floor of her bathroom with her right hand around her neck. There was fairly persuasive forensic evidence. Rocky had sent her a number of threatening text messages, and his fingerprints and strands of his hair were found in her home, and traces of Rebecca's blood were found on his shoes. An arrest warrant was issued, and he was eventually picked up 7 months later in conjunction with a serious traffic accident on the motorway at Brunnby. He had stolen a car at Finsta and was heading for the airport at Arlanda. In the accident, Rocky Kirklund suffered serious brain damage, which led to epileptic seizures in the frontal and temporal lobes of his brain. He would suffer recurrent bouts of automatism and memory loss for the rest of his life. When Eric met Rocky Kirklund, his face was crisscrossed with red scars from the accident, his arm was in plaster, and his hair had just started to grow again after several operations. Rocky was a large man with a booming voice. He was almost 2 meters tall, broad-shouldered, with big hands and a thick neck. Sometimes he would faint, falling off his chair, knocking over the flimsy table holding glasses and a jug of water, and hit his shoulder on the floor. But sometimes his epileptic attacks were almost invisible. He just seemed a bit subdued and distant, and afterwards he couldn't remember what they had been talking about. Eric and Rocky got on fairly well. The priest was undeniably charismatic. He somehow managed to give the impression of speaking straight from the heart. Eric leafs through the private journal in which he made notes during their conversations.
The various subjects can be traced from one session to the next. Rocky had neither admitted nor denied the murder. He said he couldn't remember Rebecca Hanson at all, and couldn't explain why his fingerprints had been found in her home, or how her blood came to be on his shoes. During the best of their conversations, Rocky would circle the small islands of memories in an attempt to discern a bit more. Once he said that he and Rebecca Hanson had had intercourse in the sacristy, albeit interrupted. He could remember details, such as the rough rug they had been lying on, an old gift from the young women of the parish. She had begun to menstruate, leaving a small bloodstain, like a virgin, he said. During the following conversations, he couldn't remember any of this. The conclusion of the examination was that the crime had been committed under the influence of severe mental disturbance. The team believed that Rocky Kirkland suffered from a grandiose, narcissistic personality disorder, with elements of paranoia. Eric Leafs passed a circled note, "Paying for sex plus drug abuse," in the journal, followed by some ideas for medication. Naturally, he shouldn't have had an opinion on the matter of guilt, but as time passed, Eric became convinced that Rocky was guilty, and that his mental disorder constituted a serious risk of further crimes. During one of their last sessions, Rocky was talking about a ceremony to mark the end of the school year in a church decked out with spring greenery, when he suddenly looked up at Eric and said he hadn't murdered Rebecca Hanson.
"I remember everything now. I've got an alibi for the whole of that evening," he said.
He wrote down the name Olivia and an address, then gave the sheet of paper to Eric. They carried on talking, and Rocky began to speak in broken fragments, then fell completely silent, looked at Eric, and suffered a severe epileptic attack. Afterwards, Rocky didn't remember anything. He didn't even recognize Eric, just kept whispering about wanting heroin, saying he could kill a child if only he was given 30 grams of medical diacetyl morphine in a bottle with an unbroken seal. Eric never took Rocky's claim of an alibi seriously. At best, it was a lie. At worst, Rocky could have bribed or threatened someone to support the alibi. Eric threw away the scrap of paper, and Rocky Kirkland was found guilty and sentenced to secure psychiatric care, with severe restrictions on any parole application. And 9 years later, a woman is murdered in Brumma, in a way that was reminiscent of Rebecca Hanson's murder, Eric thinks, closing the file bearing Rocky's name. Aggressive violence directed at the face, neck, and chest. But on the other hand, murders of this sort aren't altogether unusual. They can be triggered by anything from the jealousy of an ex-husband, aggression linked to Rohypnol and anabolic steroids, so-called honor killings, or a pimp making an example of a prostitute trying to break away from him. The only concrete connection is that Susanna Kern was left at the scene of the murder with her hand covering her ear, just like Rebecca Hanson was found on the floor with her hand round her own neck. Perhaps Susanna Kern merely got tangled up in the belt of her kimono during the struggle. The parallels certainly aren't unambiguous, but they are there, and they're forcing Eric to do something he should have done a long time ago. He puts the file in his desk drawer and looks up the number of senior consultant Simon Casillas at Karsudan Hospital once more.
"Casillas,"
the man answers in a voice like dried leather. "Eric Maria Bark from the Karolinska."
"Hello again.
I've checked my diary and I could actually squeeze in a visit."
"A visit?"
The sound of a squash court is audible in the background, a ball hitting the wall, the squeak of shoes.
I'm taking part in a research project for the OSHA Center at the Institute, which involves us following up on old patients right across the spectrum, which means I'm going to have to interview Rocky Kirklund. Before they end the conversation, Eric hears himself babble about the fabricated research project, about health service funding, tax declarations, online CBT, and someone called Dr. Stönkel. He slowly puts his phone down on the desk, watches the little screen turn black as it slips into dormancy. The room is perfectly still. His leather seat creaks quietly like a moored boat. Through the open window, he can hear the hiss of an evening shower approach across the gardens. He bends forward and rests his elbows on the desk, leans his head on his hands, and asks himself what on earth he's doing. "What did I just say?" he thinks. "And who the hell is Stönkel?" This could be a crazy idea, he knows that, but he also knows he has no choice. If Rocky's alibi was genuine, then he must be released, even if that would mean a media frenzy and a miscarriage of justice. Eric skims through the logbook. There are no notes about an alibi, but towards the end, one page has been torn out. He leafs forward, then stops. From that last session with Rocky, there's a faint note in pencil that Eric doesn't remember. In the middle of the page, it says, "A priest with dirty clothes," across the lines. Then the remainder of the book is blank. He stands up and goes out into the kitchen to find something to eat. While he walks through the library, he repeats to himself that he has to find out if Rocky's alibi was real. If it was genuine, then this new murder could be connected to the old one, and Eric will have to confess everything. Chapter 19. Saga Bauer is driving slowly through the vast campus of the Karolinska Institute. As she approaches Retzius Weg 5, she turns into the deserted car park and stops in front of the empty building. Even though she's tired and not wearing any makeup, hasn't washed her hair, and is wearing baggy clothes, most people would probably say she was the most beautiful person they had ever seen. Recently, there's been something hungry and hunted about her appearance. The bright blue of her eyes makes her creamy white skin look radiant. On the floor, in front of the passenger seat, is a green holdall containing underwear, a bulletproof vest, and 5 cartridges of ammunition, 45 ACP, hollow-tipped. Saga Bauer has been on sick leave from her job with the security police for more than a year, and she hasn't visited the boxing club in all that time. The only time she's missed work was during Barack Obama's visit to Stockholm. She stood at a distance and watched the president's cortege. Being constantly on the lookout for threats is an occupational hazard. She remembers the tingle that ran through her body when she identified a potential vantage point from which to fire a rocket-propelled grenade, an unguarded window. But a moment later, the danger had passed and nothing had happened. The forensic medicine department is closed. All the lights in the red brick building seem to be off, but a white Jaguar with a damaged front bumper is parked on the path right in front of the entrance. Saga leans to the side, opens the glove compartment, takes out the glass jar, and leaves the car. The air is mild and smells of freshly mown grass. She feels her Glock 21 bouncing under her left arm and can hear a faint sloshing sound from the jar as she walks. Saga has to clamber across the flowerbed to get past Nils Orlien's car. The thorns of the wild rose make a scratching sound as they let go of her military trousers. The branches sway and a few rose petals drift to the ground.
The lock of the front door is prevented from clicking shut with the help of a rolled-up information leaflet. She's been here enough times before to find her way. The grit on the poorly cleaned floor crunches as she heads down the corridor towards the swing door. She can't help smiling when she looks at the jar and the cloudy liquid, the particles circling round. The memory flashes through her, and her free hand goes involuntarily to one of the scars he left on her face, the deep cut just below her eyebrow. Sometimes she thinks he must have seen something special in her, that was why he spared her life. And sometimes she thinks that he simply considered death too easy. He wanted her to live with the lies he had made her believe, in the hell he had created for her. She'll never know. The only thing that is certain is that he chose not to kill her, and she chose to kill him. She thinks of the darkness and the deep snow as she walks down the empty corridor of the forensic medicine department. "I hit him," she whispers to herself. She moistens her mouth and in her mind's eye sees herself firing and hitting him in the neck, arm, and chest. 3 shots to the chest. She changed her magazine and shot him again when he'd fallen into the rapids. She held the flare up and saw the cloud of blood spread out around him. She ran along the bank, shooting at the dark object, and carried on firing, even though the body had been carried off by the current. "I know I killed him," she thinks, but they never found his body. The police sent divers under the ice and checked both banks with sniffer dogs. Outside the office is a neat metal sign bearing his name and title, Niels Orlien, Professor of Forensic Medicine. The door is open and the slight figure is sitting at his neat desk reading the newspaper with a pair of latex gloves on his hands. He's wearing a white polo neck shirt under his white coat and his pilot's sunglasses flash as he looks up. "You're tired, Sauka," he says amiably.
"A bit.
Beautiful, though."
"No."
He puts the newspaper down, pulls off the gloves, and notices the quizzical look in her eyes.
"To save getting ink on my fingers," he says, as though it were obvious.
Saga doesn't answer, just sets the jar down in front of him. The chopped-off finger moves slowly in the alcohol through a cloud of wispy particles. A swollen and half-rotten index finger.
"So you think that this finger belonged to Jurek Walter?" Saga says curtly.
"How did you get hold of it?"
Niels Orlien asks. He picks up the jar and holds it up to the light. The finger falls against the inside of the glass as if it were pointing at him.
"I've spent more than a year looking."
To start with, Saga Bauer borrowed sniffer dogs and walked up and down both banks of the river, from Bergesjön all the way to Hisangsvik on the Baltic coast. She followed the shoreline, combed the beaches, studied the currents of Norrfjörden all the way down to Västerfladen, and made her way out to every island, talking to anyone who went fishing in the area.
"Go on," Orlien said.
She looks up and meets his relaxed gaze behind the shimmering surface of his sunglasses. His latex gloves are lying on the desk in front of him, inside out, in 2 little heaps. One is quivering slightly, either from a draft or because of the rubber contracting.
"This morning, I was walking along the beach out at Högmarsjö," she explains. "I've been there before, but I gave it another go. The terrain on the north side is quite tricky. A lot of forest on the cliffs at the headland."
She thinks of the old man walking towards her from the other direction with an armful of silver-grey driftwood.
"You've gone quiet again."
"Sorry. I bumped into a retired churchwarden. He said he'd seen me the last time I was there and asked what I was looking for."
Saga went with him to the inhabited part of the island, Less than 40 people live there. The warden's house is tucked behind the White Chapel and freestanding bell tower. He said he found a dead body on the shore towards the end of April.
A whole body?
Orlean asks in a low voice. No, just the torso and one arm.
No head?
No one can live without a torso, she says, and can hear how agitated her voice sounds.
No,
Orlean replies calmly. The warden said the body must have been in the water all winter, because it was badly swollen and very heavy.
They look terrible,
Orlean said. He brought the body back through the forest in his wheelbarrow and laid it on the floor of the tool shed behind the chapel. But the smell drove his dog mad, so he had to take it to the old crematorium.
He cremated it?
She nods. The crematorium had been abandoned for decades, but in the middle of the overgrown foundations was a sooty brick oven with a chimney. The warden used to burn rubbish in the oven, so he knew it worked.
Why didn't he call the police? Orlean asked.
Saga thinks of the way the church warden's house stank of fried food and old clothes. His neck was streaked with dirt, and the bottles of home brew in the fridge had dirty marks from his fingers. He had a still at home. I don't know. But he did take a few pictures with his mobile in case the police showed up and started asking questions. And he kept the finger at the bottom of his fridge.
Have you got the pictures?
Yes, she says, and pulls out her phone. It must be him. Look at the gunshot wounds.
Orlean looks at the first picture. On the bare cement floor of the tool shed lies a bloated, marbled torso with just one arm. The skin has split across the chest and slipped down. There are four ragged gunshot holes on the body. The water has made a black mark on the pale grey floor, a shadow that gets narrower towards the drain in the floor.
That looks good, very good,
Niels Orlean said, handing her phone back. There is a tense look in his eyes as he gets to his feet and picks the glass jar up from the desk, and he looks at her as if he were about to say something else, but walks out of the room instead. Chapter 20 Saga follows Niels Orlean through a dark corridor with narrow wheel tracks on the floor into the closest pathology lab. The chilly fluorescent lights in the ceiling flicker a few times before settling and lighting up the white-tiled walls. Beside one of the metal tables is a desk with a computer and a large bottle of Trocadero. The room smells of disinfectant and drains. A bright yellow hose is attached to one of the taps. A trickle of water runs from the end of the hose towards the drain in the floor. Orlean walks straight over to the long, plastic-covered post-mortem table with its double trough and drainage runnels. He pulls over a chair for Saga, then places the glass jar on the slab. She watches him put on protective overalls, a mask, and latex gloves. Then he stops, quite still, in front of the jar, like an old person disappearing into a memory. Saga is on the point of saying something when Orlean takes a deep breath.
The right finger of a body found in brackish water, preserved in strong alcohol at a temperature of 8 degrees for 4 months, he says to himself. He photographs the jar from various angles, then unscrews the lid bearing the words Bob Raspberry Jam. Using a pair of steel tweezers, he removes the finger, lets it drip for a while, then puts it down on the post-mortem table. The nail has come off and is still lying in the murky liquid. A nauseating smell of rotten seawater and decaying flesh spreads through the room.
It's certainly true that the finger was removed from the body long after death, he says to Saga, with a knife or perhaps a pair of pliers or secateurs.
Orlean is breathing audibly through his nose as he carefully rolls the finger over so he can photograph it from every angle.
We can get a good fingerprint from this, he says seriously.
Saga has backed away and is standing with her hand over her mouth, watching as Orlean picks up the dead finger and holds it against a print scanner. The machine bleeps when the print has been scanned. The tissue is swollen and pudgy, but the fingerprint that appears in the little screen is still very clear. The papillary lines are really the ridges between the cells and sweat pores that develop in the epidermis while an embryo is still in the womb. Saga stares at the oval containing a labyrinth of swirls. The room feels full of suppressed anticipation. Orlean takes off his protective clothing again and logs into the computer, hooks up the scanner, and clicks on the icon with the text Live Scan.
I've got a private APHIS system, he says straight out as he clicks another icon and types in a new password.
Saga sees him search for Walter, then click to bring up the digital image of the ID form that was compiled at the time of Jurek's arrest. The sharp reproductions of the thumb and fingerprints from both hands were made in ink. Saga tries to control her breathing. Sweat is trickling down her sides from her armpits. Orlean whispers something to himself and drags the best image from LiveScan across to the search box of the APHIS system, then clicks the button saying Analysis and Comparison, and immediately gets a result.
What's happening?
Saga says, and swallows hard. The reflections of the fluorescent lights slide across his glasses. She sees his hand shake as he points at the screen.
The details of the initial level are rather vague, mostly just patterns, Orlean explains, and clears his throat quickly. The second level are so-called Galton details. You can see the length of the papillary lines and the way they relate to each other. The differences are only the result of tissue breakdown. And the third level, that's primarily concerned with the layout of pores, and there the match is perfect.
Do you mean that we've found Jurek? She whispers.
I'll send the DNA to the National Forensics Lab in Linköping, but purely as a formality, he replies with a nervous smile. You found him. There's no doubt that it's him. It's over now.
Good, she says, feeling hot tears well up in her eyes.
The initial relief is full of contradictory impulses and emptiness. Her heart is still pounding hard in her chest.
You've said all along that you were sure you killed Jurek. Why was it so important to find his body? Orlean asks.
I couldn't try to find Yuna before I'd found it, she replies, rubbing her cheeks with her hand to wipe the tears away.
Yuna's dead, Orlean says.
Yes, she smiles.
Yuna's jacket and wallet were found in the possession of a homeless man who hung around Strömparterren, at the end of the island housing the parliament building in Stockholm. Saga's watched the video of the interview plenty of times. The homeless man identified himself as Konstantin I. He usually borrowed one of the fishing boats and slept outside a heating vent. He sat in the interview room with his big beard and dirty fingers, cracked lips, and a wary look in his eyes. In a rattling voice, he told them about the big Finn, who told him to keep his distance, before taking his jacket off and swimming out into the water. He watched him swim out towards Strömbrunn until he reached the fast-flowing current and disappeared.
You don't believe he's dead? Orlean asks calmly.
Several years ago, he phoned me. He wanted me to find out some information about a woman in Helsinki in secret, Saga says. At the time, I thought the woman had something to do with the case at Birgittagården.
What about her, then?
She was seriously ill. She was in hospital for an operation. Her name was Laura Sandin,
Saga says, holding Orlean's gaze. But she was really, really Sumerlina, his wife, wasn't she?
Yes,
he nods. I tried to get hold of Laura to tell her that Yuna was dead, Saga explains. Laura had been in a cancer hospice for palliative care, but 2 days after Yuna's suicide, she was discharged to spend her last days at home. But neither Laura nor her daughter are still at their address on Elisabethsgarten.
Really?
Orlean says, his thin nostrils turning pale. They aren't anywhere, Saga says, taking a step towards him.
That's good to hear.
I think Yuna arranged his suicide so he could go and pick up his wife and daughter and go into hiding with them.
Niels Orlean's eyes are red, and his mouth is twitching slightly with emotion when he speaks.
Yuna was the only person who believed that Yurik's reach extended beyond the isolation unit. And, as usual, he was right. If we hadn't done this, Yurik would have killed Suma and Lumi, just as he killed Disa.
Niels, I need to find Yuna and tell him that Yurik Valter is dead, Saga says. He needs to know that the body's been found.
She puts her hand on his arm and sees his shoulders slump when he makes his mind up.
I don't know where they are, he eventually says. But if Suma is dying, like you say, I know where you could try looking.
Where?
Go to the Nordic Museum,
he says in a thick voice, as if he were worried about changing his mind.
There's a small bridal crown, a Sami bridal crown, made of woven roots. Look at it carefully.
Thanks.
Good luck, Orlean says seriously, then hesitates. No one wants to hug a pathologist, but...
Saga hugs him hard, then leaves the room and hurries along the corridor. Chapter 21 Saga parks in front of the large flight of steps leading up to the Nordic Museum, drinks a sip of cold coffee from a 7-Eleven mug, and looks at the people around her, all dressed for summer. It's as if she hasn't really paid attention to her surroundings before now. Adults and children, tired from the sun or long picnics, or excited and expectant on their way to the amusement park or some restaurant. She's barely noticed the summer passing her by again. Since Yuna disappeared, she has withdrawn from the world.